Welcome to Rhetoric to Reality. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and we are going to get started. If you have not yet introduced yourself in the chat, please go ahead and do that. Let me know where you're joining us from, what you do in education, if you're an administrator, a coach, a professional development specialist, a superintendent, higher ed faculty, assistant principal, college administrator. Welcome Deb from Istanbul and Pam from Virginia. Welcome. Excellent. Great to see so many people here from all around the world. As I mentioned, we are going to be doing a giveaway. I know your time is valuable. You're on enough Zoom meetings for crying out loud as it is. So to thank you for being here, we are going to be giving away 5 copies of the Instructional Leadership Challenge, and Now We're Talking. So it'll take us a few days to mail you the book, but we'll give you instant access to the Instructional Leadership Challenge. All you've got to do is just be here, you know, be commenting so that we know that there's a real person sitting there and tuning in and participating. And I will announce those winners. I need to download the chat log afterwards, so I'll announce those over email later today. So keep an eye out for that. We've got lots and lots of people tuning in from all over. And oh, hey, we've got our friend Becky from Arkansas Department of Education. Welcome. My friend Heather Bell Williams from New Brunswick is also on with us today. And we will, if the conference happens, we will be speaking at the Learning Forward Conference in December. So I just wanted to mention one thing about their registration for that conference, as well as give you some of the keynote speakers here. They are doing kind of a money back guarantee. If you cancel by November, some date in November, there's kind of a no-risk registration. We're in a time when who really knows what's going to happen with in-person professional development, with conferences and things like that. Often we don't have a lot of clarity about when school is going to start back or what that's going to look like. But I wanted to put that out there because I know ASCD was already canceled this year, and I'm hopeful that that things will be in a place where Learning Forward is able to happen. And if it is, I will see you there. Heather and I will be presenting on getting into classrooms 500 times a year. Heather's been doing that for a good 4 years now, and is going to be sharing just the impact that has had on her school. All right, so in this webinar, our focus is on changing teacher practice and on how we can stop burning leadership capital, which I think is one of our most precious resources, on the aspects of our work that don't actually produce changes in practice. I think we all take the evaluation process seriously. We take our formal observations and our write-ups and our ratings very seriously. But if we're honest with ourselves, we can't just do that process harder in order to change teacher practice more, because it's not necessarily designed to change teacher practice. We'll talk about what it is designed for in just a moment. But if we could stop burning our most precious resource on things that don't work, would that be like a positive outcome, right? And I was thinking, it's almost like we're lighting money on fire. Every time we erode trust, every time we damage a relationship by trying to get more serious and more aggressive about something that doesn't actually work. So I thought, okay, I need a picture of like lighting money on fire, because leadership capital is like money to leaders, right? Like we need it in order to do what we're here to do. But I thought, in these times, money is maybe not even the most precious resource. Maybe it's toilet paper. I was very relieved. I was able to stock up last time I went to the grocery store. But as painful as it is to see something like this going up in flames, it's painful to me to see leadership capital being squandered on things that we know we're supposed to do, but that don't get us the results that we want. Angela says, no, not the toilet paper. Absolutely. So we're going to start talk about how we can start redirecting that leadership capital toward things that actually change teacher practice. The concern that I have anytime we talk about getting more serious, ambitious in terms of our work as instructional leaders, is that we'll become overbearing, that we will actually increase resistance and make it harder for people to trust, harder for people to change. So in order to get around that problem, I believe we need to understand the sources of authority that teachers look to, the way that teachers make decisions about their practice, because teachers are professionals, right? It's not just about doing what you're told. and being a good teacher. You know, there's a professional judgment that needs to be there for teachers to do their best work. So we're going to talk about how to influence that professional judgment, get away from second guessing. I really think we face an epidemic of second guessing in our profession, where administrators come in, we say, here's what you did well, you did this well, you did this well, you did this well, I think you should have done that other thing differently. All right, keep up the good work, I'll check back on you. And really, it's a very administrator-driven process when it doesn't always need to be. Often there are big opportunities to tap into teacher autonomy, to tap into teachers' professional identity to get better results. And this is something that we can all do, right? You do not have to have 40 years of experience in the principalship in order to change practice, even for veteran teachers. And a lot of what you're going to hear from me in terms of my philosophy and my approach and the specific strategies comes from the fact that I was a principal at a very, very young age. I was hired at the age of 26 to work in a school, to lead a school with a veteran staff, many of whom had been in the school longer than I had been alive. And if I had told myself that I have to, you know, build 15 years of credibility here before I can really change teacher's practice, I wouldn't have gotten anything done. So you are going to hear from that perspective from me today. But I want to ask you specifically why you are here today. Why are you not on Facebook right now? Why are you attending a webinar on changing teacher practice? I'm guessing that it's because of some belief that you have. And I'd like you to take a moment to just reflect and share in the chat, if you would, what do you believe in or what are you committed to that prompted you to spend an hour being here? Alma says, I want to be an effective leader. And I'll keep an eye on those. I'm sure they'll start scrolling too fast in just a moment. Empower teachers. Let's see, to change teacher practice, I need to change how I affect change. Love that. Changing the future for our students. Help kids by helping teachers be more effective. Believe that we have to have a positive relationship with teachers. Love it. Build teacher capacity. Be more effective as a leader. Spend more time in classrooms. Wonderful. Help teachers reinvent themselves. Yeah. So our topic today is not specifically around, you know, the online shift, and we don't know how long that's going to last or what that's going to look like for the future. But certainly people are having to navigate change and develop new skills, even if they felt highly competent, felt highly successful with what they're doing. You know, the circumstances we're in right now do put that mandate for change kind of on everybody's plate all of a sudden. So thank you very much for those. Tap into teacher passions. All right, I'm going to have a lot to choose from when it comes to our giveaway. And again, if you just joined us, welcome. Oh yeah, like 50 people just joined us. We are doing a giveaway, 5 copies of my book and the Instructional Leadership Challenge. And I'm just going to pick those from the chat, more or less at random. So the more times you're in the chat, the better chances you have of being one of our 5 winners. And I'll announce those via email later today. All right, so here is where I think we run into a little bit of trouble. And I said this over email earlier in the week. I think the evaluation process, the supervision and evaluation observation process, has a lot of different audiences other than teachers. And because of that, it doesn't always serve the needs of teachers when it comes to their growth, their improvement. If we are so focused on meeting the needs of the public, meeting the needs of human resources, giving them the documents that they need, giving the public and the parents and the students the assurances they need that the teacher in every classroom, the teacher in their child's classroom is competent, you know, it's a different set of goals than we might have if our sole focus was to help the individual teacher grow. And I know we are going to continue doing the traditional teacher supervision and evaluation activities. I don't want to discourage that in any way, because these audiences do need us to do that work. They need us to ensure and document and demonstrate that every teacher is competent, and if not, that we're doing something about that. And I think the process is reasonably well designed around the needs of all those other stakeholders, right? The teacher supervision and evaluation process does accomplish the goal of ensuring that every teacher gets observed, hopefully. That's typically required, and hopefully if it's required, it's getting done. Of documenting performance, you know, we do a pretty good job of taking notes from a lesson and lining that up with some sort of evaluation rubric and documenting someone's performance, wherever that falls on the rubric, from unsatisfactory to proficient to distinguished or whatever your scale is. It does a pretty good job of kicking off whatever those next steps are. Maybe you have a probation process, maybe you have a non-renewal process, maybe you have some coaching support that comes in to work with a teacher if their performance is below expectations. And ultimately, all of that does a pretty good job of creating the appearance of accountability. Now, hopefully that appearance is created by reality, right? Hopefully the theatrics that we go through to demonstrate, oh yes, we take teacher evaluation very seriously. We have a department of teacher effectiveness in larger districts. We have a rubric, we have an evaluation system. Anyone can download our rubric and see what teachers are held accountable for. But we have to be careful that all of that effort to please other stakeholders doesn't just become rhetoric that takes the place of real instructional leadership. Does that make sense? Does that make sense that if we put so much effort into pleasing those other stakeholders, that we might lose some of our focus on helping the individual teacher change practice and get better at what they need to get better at? Like, we can do all the documentation in the world, but you know, looking at the speedometer on the car doesn't make the car drive any faster, right? The measurement itself, the assessment itself, does not necessarily help teachers improve. And I would actually argue that the formal process is not the best place to focus if we want to see people improve. You know, we think of it like this, right? We think, okay, this person is at point A, they're over here where they're doing some things fairly well, but there's an opportunity to maybe go through a learning curve, maybe struggle to try some new strategies, and then come out on the other side at a much higher level of performance. This is what we think is going to happen when we're working with teachers. Okay, the person's at point A, they could be at point B, so I'm just gonna lead them through that process through traditional supervision and evaluation. I'm gonna give them feedback, I'm gonna observe and take notes, we're gonna talk about it, and they're gonna go from point A to point B. But here's where we run into a little bit of trouble. Because the teacher evaluation process is so high stakes, because people can literally be fired if they do not pass their evaluation, they can be put on probation, and so forth. Bad things can happen. What teachers are concerned about is not just the potential to go from point A to point B. They're concerned about the risk of getting evaluated while they are at point C, while they're stuck in the improvement curve, the learning curve, right? I've seen this called an implementation dip, or you know, that temporary kind of drop in performance that comes whenever we're trying something new. Right? We want to get from point A to point B, but along the way, we have to kind of go through what I've labeled as point C here. And teachers are rightly fearful that they will have their evaluation done while they're still at point C. So the risk-taking is real risk-taking, right? This is not a hypothetical risk that someone will get a bad evaluation and get put, like, that happens. It's a legitimate fear. And if we are going to help teachers grow, we know that fear is not our friend. We know that risk that's very real, that's there, is going to hold people back from doing their best work and from trying things that are new and that are going to make them better. Yeah, Kyle says you can't grow if you don't get uncomfortable. Absolutely. And I think what we've got to do is we've got to make sure that discomfort doesn't fall into the zone of actual danger for teachers. So again, thank you so much for that. There's such great conversation going on in the chat, and we'll use that again for our book giveaway. Thank you so much for being here. What I will do, Zoom will tell me who stays all the way to the end. So please keep that up and keep up that discussion. I see some great interactions taking place here. All right, let's get into the three shifts that we can take to go from making this all about the rhetoric that pleases external stakeholders. You know, like we want the local TV station, if they ever have to report on something that's going on in school, we want them to know that we have a defensible teacher evaluation process. We want them to know that this is all going to hold up if there's some scrutiny. But we also want to do things that will actually change teacher practice. So I want to give you three shifts here, and I'll put these on one by one, and then I'll put them all on the screen at once if you are taking screenshots or anything like that. The first shift to go from rhetoric to reality in instructional leadership is a shift in belief. And this is going to be a controversial one. So I would love to have your thoughts on this, and I would love to have your thinking in real time on this, because this is a tough one. I believe that feedback does not actually change teacher practice. And I'm going to say that again, because that's not going to sound right. Like this is going to be very counterintuitive. I believe that feedback does not necessarily change teacher practice. That instead, the shift toward reality that we need to make is toward the belief and the understanding that it's conversation that changes teacher practice. And I'm getting a lot of reactions in the chat here. I love this. All right. I think one of the ways we can kind of discern some principles for instructional leadership is to go outside of instructional leadership and think about our own lives and how we make decisions. You know, like if you have ever made a decision about your faith, maybe you started going to a different church, or maybe you changed your beliefs about politics and switched political parties, or changed your support in the primary from one candidate to another. I'm going to guess that in most cases, it was a conversation with someone else that you cared about, whose opinion you valued, that led to that change in practice. Feedback can be a part of it, but feedback is not really what does the heavy lifting. I was in the grocery store the other day, and I didn't have a mask yet, so I had a scarf wrapped around my face a couple of times, and I normally wear glasses when I'm out because I'm kind of nearsighted, and when I had the scarf over my face, my glasses fogged up, so I put my glasses up on top of my head so I could see where I was going. And I was in the checkout at the grocery line, at the grocery store, and another shopper, lady who's in the next aisle, decided to give me some feedback to try to change my practice. She said, you know, you should really leave your glasses on because they say it can get in through your eyes. And I looked at her and said, oh, okay, yeah, well, I mean, my glasses fog up when I put them on when I'm wearing the scarf, so I can't really do that. And then she kind of repeated her point, you know, you really need to be, you should have your glasses on. And of course, there's not been any recommendation that people cover their eyes or wear glasses when they don't wear glasses. And I wasn't going to walk around with fogged up glasses all day. And I thought, how often is our feedback coming across to other people the same way? That's like, I didn't really ask for that feedback. It was kind of unsolicited. It's really not going to change my practice. What's going to determine how I protect myself and other people when I'm out and about is, you know, the research that we're all doing, the conversation that we're having with people we care about and people we trust. So relationships are key, as Jill is saying. Yeah, absolutely. That relationship is key. I really do not want unsolicited feedback from random people at the grocery store. And if I am an instructional leader, to some extent, I have something in common with that random lady at the grocery store when it comes to giving feedback to teachers, especially if you are in a new position, you know, if you've just moved into a new school, if you will be starting in a new school, we've got to be careful about the way that our feedback comes across, because if it's not part of a conversation, it can really sound like that. You need to be putting your glasses, you know, that kind of reaction can be triggered. That kind of defensive reaction is very understandable. So the first shift from feedback to conversation as what changes practice. And so many great points being made in the chat here. Thank you, everyone. The second shift from rhetoric to reality is that rather than allow the process, the steps of the process, the required procedures that we go through to drive the decisions that we make in teacher supervision and evaluation, I believe we need to allow evidence to drive those decisions. Now, we're still going to follow the process, but what I think we need to let go of is the myth that the process itself forms our judgment for us, right? When you decide, do I want this person to continue to work here next year? Does this person deserve a continuing contract, or does this person need to be put on probation? When you make that decision, the decision is not the inevitable and clear outcome of simply following the process. The decision that you make is still going to be a holistic judgment that you make based on all the evidence that you have collected. And this is where often the formal and informal evaluation and supervision processes can be a little tricky to navigate. Typically, we are officially only allowed to use formal observations as evidence. Right? The formal observation process, yeah, we have to have the facts, we have to have the written evidence, there has to be a certain kind of gotcha proof process for gathering that evidence. You know, typically we have to pre-announce formal observations. But at the end of the day, at the end of the school year, you are ultimately making a holistic decision. You're not simply saying, well, I didn't see anything terrible in our formal observation, so I guess you're fine. you know you can't do that. And I want to ask you, if you have someone who has put on the dog and pony show, who's gone through the formal observation process, and yet you know that things are not okay, you know you would not put your own kid in that classroom, are you okay with trusting your gut and doing what it takes to get the evidence you need? I want to ask you, are you okay with looking beyond just the minimum required steps in the process and saying, look, based on my professional judgment and based on the evidence that I've gathered, even though that goes above and beyond the evaluation process, are you okay with trusting yourself to make the right call about a teacher's performance? Even if they rang all the bells, they made the dog jump through the hoop in the formal observations. If you would not put your own kid in that class, do you trust yourself to make that holistic judgment based on evidence? I'm not talking about hearsay. I'm not talking about rumor. I'm talking about your firsthand knowledge of that teacher's practice. Do you trust yourself to see those patterns and to make those evidence-based decisions and not just say, well, your observation was fine, so I guess you're fine? Do you trust yourself that way? Jody says, yes, it's what's best for our students. And Lynn says that, you know, the opposite of this happens all the time. Teachers who have good evaluations, but it doesn't show up in the data. You know, it doesn't show up when you stop by the conversation unannounced, right? Ken says, absolutely. Eric says, I would completely trust myself. Yeah, right. And here's, yeah, Sandra, I think this is a great point. We cannot really make an evaluation decision based only on one observation. But here's the thing. That's totally normal in our profession. It is completely normal for teachers to be evaluated based on one formal observation and, you know, 0 to 3 informal kind of visits. It is completely normal for instructional leaders to almost never get into classrooms. So I am on a personal mission to get administrators into classrooms more on an informal basis. I think amazing things can happen when we do that. Rhonda says, yeah, that is why we must get into classrooms. Because even if that evidence that we gather from those informal visits doesn't officially show up in the post-observation report, it's going to inform our judgment. And we're going to make better evidence-based judgments if we don't limit ourselves to just the evidence we get from the required process, because it's a bare minimum process designed for other stakeholders, not designed for you and the high stakes decisions you need to make and for teachers and the improvement work that you lead them through. All right, the third shift is one from letting, you know, kind of buzzwords about best practice define our shared expectations toward allowing a shared instructional framework, a detailed rubric, define our shared expectations. And here's what I mean by this shift. Often we will take a single word or a single concept as the shorthand for the improvements that we're trying to bring about. Like a lot of people will say, well, I'm really trying to get my teachers to differentiate more. I want to see more differentiation, or I want to see more personalization, or I want to see more language supports for our ELL students. We'll have a concept that is a good concept. It's a, you know, there are some best practices embedded in that, but there's not enough detail. And it's so concise that it's basically just a buzzword. And when we use that buzzword, people don't necessarily think about the same things that we think about. So I want to ask you, have you ever been using one of those best practice words in a conversation and then realized that as a result of your conversation, you were actually talking about completely different things? Has that ever happened to you where you're in a conversation, you think, yeah, we want to see more differentiation, and the other person is sharing their thoughts about differentiation, and you realize we're talking about two completely different concepts here. We're not at all on the same page. Yvette says, for sure. Jason says, yep, constantly. Yep. Happens all the time, right? If we're talking about rigor, if we're talking about higher order questions, you know, simply saying this is a best practice, you need to do that best practice more, and you know, kind of carrying a big stick about that practice isn't going to get us there, because often we're not on the same page. We need to have much more detailed shared expectations, right? Good deal. Yeah, rigor especially, Tanisha says, because that, you know, what it looks like depends a lot on your definition. All right, so these are the three shifts from seeing feedback as what changes practice to seeing conversation as what changes practice, from seeing process as what drives our decisions to seeing evidence as what drives our decisions. And third, from seeing simply a buzzword as or a single term, it can be a good research-based term, seeing that as defining our shared expectations to seeing a detailed rubric or framework that can create kind of a roadmap for growth. Now, let me ask you this. Do you believe that if you have authentic, evidence-based conversations with teachers about their practice, you use that language of your shared framework, there's a roadmap, a continuum of growth, and you're providing not just feedback, but you're actually having evidence-based conversations with teachers and getting them thinking and reflecting about their growth, and then you're coming back, not just again next year, but you're coming back to continue that conversation. Do you believe that you can get teachers to change their practice? Let me know in the chat. Do you believe that if you have these evidence-based conversations, that if you have these clear shared expectations, that you can change teachers' practice? Diana says yes. Karai says yes. Lauren says yes. Absolutely, indeed. Yes, yes, yes. I believe you can do it because, frankly, I didn't believe that I could do it because, like I said, I was 26 years old when I was hired, and I had teachers who had been teaching for 20, 30 years in the same building. And you know what? I saw it happen. And again, I'm going to share with you some of the strategies that worked for me that I adopted because I was young and my teachers were very experienced, but that also work incredibly well for getting around resistance. So even if you're not young, even if you've been in this game a long time and you have a lot of trust built up, the resistance can still be there because often that teacher resistance comes from a place of fear. And you've got to find ways to get around that. But these are things that have not just worked for me, but that have worked for tons and tons of people, especially some of our graduates from the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program. If you are a Navigator member, by the way, you have access to this program. I know we had a large number of people join our Navigator program recently. This is in your dashboard. Donna is here today. Heather is here today. Thank you so much for being here. Some of the best instructional leaders I know, administrators and coaches and academic directors, great people. So we said that those shifts allow us to kind of stop playing the rhetoric game, right? Or putting on the theatrics to please other stakeholders and really allow us to get to the heart of instructional leadership. But there's a little bit of a paradox when it comes to getting more serious. There's a little bit of a challenge around ramping things up. And I could see this, you know, both in my own practice and in the practice of my colleagues when I was a principal in Seattle, you know, just as we tried different things over time, we walk a fine line between, on the one hand, being so in your face in classrooms so much, having really, really tough conversations with people, really driving and being impatient for improvement. You know, a lot of people here probably have gotten some pushback from staff for being impatient for improvement because we want what's best for kids, right? We want to see the best possible practice so that our kids can learn as much as possible. But that impatience has to not come across as micromanagement. It has to not come across as harassment. And it has to really enlist teachers in doing their own growth. Raishan says, critical to balance pressure and support. Absolutely. So on the one hand, we don't want to be so in your face that we just generate resistance and resentment. But on the other hand, we don't want to be normal. And what's normal in our profession? What is normal among all the people who have never attended a webinar or a training or read a book on changing teacher practice? What is normal in our profession? It's not normal to take instructional leadership very, very seriously. That's not the risk that most people, that's probably the risk that you face, is that you take it too seriously. But the risk that most administrators in our profession really fall into is staying in the office with the door shut and never getting into classrooms except the minimum that they are required to. And there are good reasons for that. You know, people have way too much on their plates, but it is normal to be basically a laissez-faire administrator and to say, you know what, I trust my teachers. They're going to improve. They set goals. You know, I hold them accountable for those goals, and they've kind of got this. They do it on their own. There's a fine line between being too aggressive and being too hands off. Do you think we can do better than either of those extremes? If we're thoughtful about this, do you believe that we can do better than, in the one hand, just being on everybody's case and being in their face and giving them all this unsolicited feedback that they're not ready for, on the one hand, and on the other hand, just being kind of hands off and saying good luck with that? Do you think we can do better? Jody says we 100% can. And I agree. But here's the paradox we are somewhat stuck in. The formal supervision and evaluation process is not going to get us there. Simply following that process harder, saying, I'm going to triple check your goals. I'm going to make sure they're super, super, super great goals. I'm going to look at your data. I'm going to make sure that your data isn't inflated. I'm going to make sure that you're, you know, doing all of this to the nth degree. If we do that, we are going to be too much for people. Have you ever had a year where you realize in retrospect, you know what? I kind of went too hard on people this year. I really wanted to see some great things happen, and I pushed in some ways that just became unhelpful. Has that ever happened to you? Francis says, yes. Heather, I know we've talked about that a little bit, that, you know, our own impatience can really push people, you know, to the breaking point sometimes, you know, depending on what's going on in their own lives. And we do that for a good reason. You know, our intentions are good, but the formal process is just not designed to be driven that hard, right? It's just not designed to do that job well. So how do we get teachers to change, knowing that change requires vulnerability and the evaluation process just automatically puts people on the defensive? You know, there's an inherent degree of theatrics to the evaluation process, right? When you go and see that pre-scheduled lesson, you know, you said a week ago that you're coming tomorrow, you know, that lesson is going to be perfect. The kids have been trained and warned to be on their best behavior. Maybe there is more review going on than you're aware. We know that's the best case scenario. And we know there are a lot of theatrics going on. So this is not something that I think we can really do away with or change. You know, it is what it is. It's not really either good or bad, but it means we need a different plan if we're going to change practice. Yeah, great comments here about recognizing that feeling. I love this quote from Lao Tzu. And I want you to, you know, look past the single gender that's mentioned here. I know probably over 50% of people here are women. And of course, we would include both men and women in this. But I love this quote about the quiet power of effective leadership. A leader is best when people barely know he exists. When his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will say, we did it ourselves. How powerful is that? To, I don't want to say necessarily trick people into changing, but to empower people to change and to direct people in such a subtle and skillful way that they don't even really remember your role. They think we did it ourselves, right? An effective facilitator often is forgettable. I've had some great PLC meetings. I had the privilege in Seattle of being part of principal PLCs that were facilitated by outside expert facilitators. And one of the greatest compliments I can give them is that I barely remember them, because it was not the me show. Or, you know, for the facilitator, it was not the look at how brilliant I am. It was not the look at how great I am show. I don't even remember some of their names, but I remember learning. I remember changing my practice, and I remember growing because that facilitator did that job so well. And if there had not been a facilitator, we probably would have just kind of griped about, you know, all the things that were under our skin that day and talked about logistics and the cafeteria and, you know, all the paperwork that we had to do. The facilitator made the work happen, but was eminently forgettable. And I mean that as a compliment. But how do we do that? Tremaine says, I should be able to fade to black. How do we do that though, when the process looks like this? For a typical observation, we choose a focus. Maybe we collaborate on that, but, you know, maybe I want to see something, you know, in this next round of observation, we choose a focus. I observe, I take notes, I recap what I saw in the post-conference, I bring something up that I want to get the teacher talking about, I share my opinion about what I saw and the evidence that I gathered, I make a recommendation about what the teacher needs to do differently, and then I follow up to make sure that that happens. And I think we've got to ask ourselves kind of the Harry Wong question, who is doing the work here? In this typical administrator-driven process, whoever is doing the most work is doing the most learning. So if our goal is to develop ourselves as observers, great, we're knocking that one out of the park. But if our goal is to change teacher practice, who needs to be doing the work? Who needs to be doing the intellectual work? Yeah, those who work learn, says Kimberly. Absolutely. We have got to get the teachers to do, you know, maybe not all of the steps, like we're probably still going to be the one taking notes, but the reflection, the cognition, what Charlotte Danielson calls the intellectual work of teaching and improving your practice needs to be done by the teacher. We can't do that for the teacher, but we can create the conditions where it occurs. And we, make no mistake, we have to create those conditions, because if we simply walk people through the process, often that process will contain a lot of bird walks. Have you ever heard that term, bird walking? You know, you probably had, I had a high school teacher who was a huge bird walker. My high school chemistry teacher was just a terrible bird walker. And he would get off on these ridiculous tangents and we would hardly ever get through the lesson. And we know that in some of our feedback conversations, if we're not careful, people will use those opportunities to birdwalk and to complain about the parents and to complain about the students and to complain about the curriculum and not talk about their own practice. And those conversations, without skillful facilitation, absolutely will become a birdwalk that does not change practice. And remember the theatrics, you know, the idea that we have to go through this process. A lot of people's goal in that process becomes, I'm going to birdwalk and I'm going to smile and nod enough to get Justin to leave. That becomes the goal for a lot of people, right? They know this is not, I don't have to actually improve or change everything. I have to make it look like I'm changing something and just get through the process. That is not what we want, right? So on the one hand, if we push too hard and we tell the teacher, you know, everything we want them to do, we make that a administrator-driven process or a coach-driven process, then we can simply spark resistance and get less change. On the other hand, if we just need people to play the game, we're going to end up with just theatrics. Yeah, Tammy says, teachers just want the administrator to tell them what they want to see and be compliant and not grow. Yeah, absolutely. And again, of course, that comes from a logical desire to not get a bad evaluation. But yeah, we've got to find the opportunity for growth somewhere else. And that growth is going to happen most likely if it can happen along an established pathway. So I love the idea of having that pathway laid out for every teacher. I'm a big fan of Danielson. People were asking earlier my opinion on Danielson and Marzano. I'm not as familiar with using Marzano personally. I use Danielson as an administrator, and there are other great rubrics for teacher evaluation out there. The Center for Educational Leadership's 5D Plus rubric is also great. Kim Marshall has a good rubric. There are lots of good teacher evaluation rubrics. But whatever area you're looking to help people grow in, even if it's something that's not part of your evaluation system, but it's just part of a school improvement effort, maybe you're becoming a responsive classroom school, or maybe you're becoming an AVID school or an international baccalaureate school, whatever expectations you have, if you can turn those into a rubric that creates a growth pathway, amazing things can happen. And the properties of some of those rubrics, you've probably seen these. I'll give an example or two here in just a moment. But they break practice down into specific areas. You know, it's very detailed. It's not just a buzzword. It's not just, we are focusing on differentiation this year. Because we know if we just say one word, people are going to have all different definitions of that. So we're being very specific. We're breaking it down. We're organizing that rubric by category. And then we're breaking that rubric into levels of performance. So we can not only say, are you doing differentiation, but how are you doing on that? And then that rubric itself creates the next step. Yeah, there are lots of great rubrics out there. Kim Marshall's is a free one. If you go to marshallmemo.com, he has open sourced this. A lot of schools modify his expectations for, you know, for their own. Charlotte Danielson's is out there as well. It's pretty easy to find. And I think Danielson's is probably the best because it covers all the bases in a way that works K through 12. But look at this rubric. So we've got a couple of different specific areas here. This is under delivery of instruction, expectations. On the far right, this one's organized best to worst. So on the far right here, the teacher gives up on some students as hopeless, just has very low expectations. So if I've got someone who has very low expectations for students, I can look in the next column over and see, okay, what do I really want the next step to be? Because this person is not going to go from the worst to the best in one leap. There's going to be a developmental pathway here. So I need to get this person to go from giving up on some students as hopeless to, you know, sending the right messages that this subject is important, you know, trying to do some of the basics of motivation, but that's not enough. So we'll go another column over here, conveys to students, this is important, you can do it, and I'm not going to give up on you, right? If I could get this teacher to go from giving up on students as hopeless to you can do it and I'm not going to give up on you, that would be a huge win, right? And yeah, Brandy's saying that allows you to differentiate for teachers. Yeah, we probably have lots of people who don't need to hear that they need to reinforce that they're not going to give up. Like, some people are fine on that. This is where we zoom into the specific changes that each teacher needs to make. And we can have those conversations and say, you know, so I saw you were working with a group that was kind of struggling. Let's look at our rubric for expectations here. And, tell me some of your thoughts as far as your expectations for that group of students. You can read the rubric, I'll read the rubric, and you tell me, what do you think is going on with that group of students and what can we do to move them forward? And if that teacher looks at your rubric and says, you know what, I actually have given up on these students as hopeless, they're probably not going to say that. They're going to say, well, you know, I've really been emphasizing that this is important stuff. They really need to work at it. They can get it. I think what I need to focus on next is letting them know that I'm not going to give up on them. I'm going to stay on their case until they do get it done, till they master these concepts. And in that moment, we can create the self-efficacy that perhaps was lacking before. Maybe that teacher didn't really believe that he was capable of helping those students master this concept. Maybe he had kind of given up on them. But when the pathway is clear, when the pathway is laid out in writing, amazing things can happen. Now, we're not here just to talk about these, you know, these rubrics are pages and pages long. I highly encourage you to invest some time in using them, reviewing them, talking about them with your staff, developing your own. Big fan of developing your own. But I want to give one more example. Often we start with a problem that we kind of perceive. We say, okay, I think I know what's going on with this guy. He just doesn't get our kids. You know, maybe this, you know, this is a teacher who, you know, kind of a middle-aged white guy taught in a school that has changed demographically over the years. And now he's just a bad fit for, he just doesn't get our kids. Let's say we're talking about an English teacher at the secondary level, and you have some concerns that the curriculum that this teacher is using, it just is not like, it's a whole bunch of, you know, dead white guys writing that's being taught by, you know, an older white guy, and it's just not connecting with the students. The problem that we identify off the top of our heads that we kind of intuit is just doesn't get our kids, just doesn't connect with our kids. It is very difficult to use the formal evaluation process to change that without a growth pathway and without some really good conversations. So what I might do is I might look at a high quality framework like Danielson, and she's got 1B here, demonstrating knowledge of students. And I might think to myself, okay, let's look at number one here. The teacher displays minimal understanding of how students learn and little knowledge of their varied approaches to learning. Yep. Knowledge and skills, special needs, interests, and cultural heritages. Yep, that's a big gap for this guy. And does not indicate that such knowledge is valuable. And I'm nodding my head as I read this and think about this one particular teacher. But then I'm not just saying, okay, now I have a diagnosis. I'm also saying to myself, I have a next step. Okay, now I need to help this person get beyond the cultural stereotypes. I need to help them understand the cultural backgrounds that our students are coming from, but get to know the individual students, get to go beyond some of the basics. And if I jump down to the bottom here, level 4, where do I ultimately want this guy to end up? The teacher understands the active nature of student learning, acquires information about levels of development for individual students, systematically acquires knowledge about students' needs and skills and interests and cultural heritages. Okay, now I have a pathway. Now I can be specific about where I want to take this person. And I don't even have to fully direct all of that growth if I draw the teacher's attention to that rubric and to the evidence. This is what our conversations can be about. And how we have those conversations, how we bring those issues to the teacher's attention has a lot to do with where they are in terms of their career. And this is a table that I pulled from our certification program. I believe that there are 3 primary stages that people go through as they develop as professionals. And I want you to think back for a moment to your either first year of teaching or your student teaching experience where you had a mentor, right? You have a master teacher that you're teaching under and you kind of do what they say, right? Do you remember being a student teacher? Remember that back in the day where you would kind of stand nervously at the front of the room and give the announcements and your teacher would say, you know, talk louder or make eye contact, you know, you get those. Yeah. Probably not the happiest memory, but you know, one of the trials by fire that brought us all to where we are today. As a novice teacher, as a novice professional in anything, you mostly look to your mentor to tell you what to do, to help you make decisions. And if your mentor confidently gives you an answer to one of your questions, you can be like, all right, great. Now I know what to do. I'm going to run with it. You're not really going to question it. But over time, naturally, you start to look at more than one person's opinion and you start to look around you to the culture of your school. And you start to say, okay, what are the expectations here? You know, I had my undergraduate training or I had my teacher licensure training, and that taught me some things. But for the most part, most teachers, especially in the early stages of their career, look around them. They look at their peers. They talk to their peers and they say, how do we do things here? What do we do? And the culture of the school has an enormous impact on teachers' performance when they are at that stage of their career. And most teachers, probably numerically, most teachers are at that stage most of the time where they're looking to their peers. They're looking to the culture of the school to direct them in how to make decisions and in what to do. That's why it is so powerful to have those expectations be written, to not just be informal, like let me ask my neighbor, but to actually be documented, to actually be something that we train teachers on when they are hired. Here is how we do things. If you are an AVID school, if you do the AVID, you know, all the different kind of college readiness strategies, I know a lot of I was a middle school teacher, a lot of middle schools use AVID. You know you have to onboard your new teachers in the ways of AVID if you're going to remain an AVID school. And when you do that, it's incredibly powerful, right? It can create just a tremendous amount of growth in a very short time. But that also goes in the other direction, right? Like if you take someone who's fine in one school and you put them into a school that basically has no culture or has a toxic or dysfunctional culture, and that shared expectations are all about survival and, you know, getting away with the, you know, whatever you can, you know, if you put someone in a culture where the expectations are worse than their own experience, then their performance is actually going to go down. Right? But that's not the final stage. We, you know, we want to uphold those high expectations. We want to have them clear. We want to onboard people to them. We want to point to them whenever there's a problem so that we have a shared roadmap for growth. But it's important to understand, and this is where I'm pulling from my own experience as a very, very young principal, that people don't stay at that stage for their entire careers, or at least not everybody does. Some people, and you know, probably eventually to some extent most people, but not everyone, advance to what I call the professional stage, where people no longer just look to their peers for what to do. They trust their own judgment more than anyone else. And if you have ever worked in a dysfunctional school, if you've ever worked in a school with a very chaotic culture, maybe a lot of leadership turnover, maybe a lot of discipline problems, I promise you could find at least one teacher within that school who was just an island of calm. Give me a yes in the chat if you've seen that teacher. That teacher who was in a terrible, terrible environment. No one could be expected to do good work in that environment, but there is somebody who's pulling it off. Maybe there are 10 people. Maybe it's a third of the staff who is just an island of competence and excellence surrounded by a sea of chaos. The reason they're able to do that is because they're not looking to their peers who leave early and show up late and don't plan their lessons and just complain about the kids. They are trusting their own professional judgment because that judgment has been refined over the years to the point that they have confidence in it. They know how to get results for their students, even if nobody else is. And if we have those people, we've got to hang on to them. And one of the reasons we don't hang on to them is because we go too hard on the top-down instructional leadership and we don't recognize the professionalism of those people. Yeah, Emily says, watching those teachers is amazing. Yeah, our goal there is not so much to make them grow, because they're going to grow on their own. Our goal there is to keep them and extend their influence. And that's why differentiated instructional leadership is so crucial. All right, so these conversations that can change teacher practice need to be based on three shared things. We get into a classroom, formally or informally, we talk with the teacher about their practice. We need to have shared evidence, right? We take notes, we provide them to the teacher, we talk about what we saw. Video could be a part of that. If you're using video, maybe not the best place to start. if trust is not in place, but we have to have shared evidence and we have to have shared expectations, a common framework. Your evaluation system probably provides that to some extent. And then you may have improvement specific rubrics that you're working from. And then the third factor is we have to have shared professionalism. We have to play the right role and respect the person who is participating in the conversation with us. Love the comments coming in the chat. By the way, we are giving away 5 copies of my book, and I will have plenty of people to choose from. Just make sure you keep those comments coming in. Yeah, Becky, great comment about master teachers. Love it. Love it. So let's talk about the role that we can play in those conversations, because it's not just one role that we need to play in order to move practice forward, depending on where the other person is. So the 3 roles that I've identified, and you may have seen some of my articles on this, the 3 hats we can wear, I call the boss, the coach, and the leader. Sometimes we need to be the boss. And this was one, as you know, like I said, I was a very young principal in a school with a veteran staff. I did not like to wear the boss hat because it just felt like I was trying to prove something. You know, give me a yes if this is your least favorite hat to wear to be the boss. Sometimes though, we need to, right? Sometimes someone is not doing what they need to do, and we just got to tell them, look, I know you know what to do. You're just not doing it. And I'm the one who has to tell you, you got to do it. I had a teacher who, you've heard me tell this story recently probably, I had a teacher who was not planning his math lessons. He was just winging it every day. He'd open the textbook, be like, all right, today we're on page 47. And that was the extent of his planning. And I said, look, you got to plan. You have to plan in advance. You have to know what the objectives of the lesson are in advance. You got to think through these practice problems. And it does not work to coach that teacher to be better. They already know what to do. They know how to be better. They just need to do it. So sometimes we've got to wear that boss hat. Most of the time, though, we want to be in the cognitive zone. We want to be a reflective partner. We want to play the coaching role and change teacher thinking. Give me a me in the chat. Say the word me in the chat if this is your favorite role to play. It is mine. Yeah, definitely my favorite role to change teacher thinking through reflective feedback. And for most teachers, most of the time, this is where we want to be, right? This is going to solve the problem for most teachers most of the time. But there's one more role that I discovered pretty early on as a principal that sometimes we need to neither tell nor just ask the teacher what to do. It's not just about direction or reflection. Sometimes we need to listen and wear what I call the leader hat and think, you know what? This teacher is doing the best they can do under the circumstances, but it's my job to change the circumstances. And once I've changed the circumstances, then we can circle back and talk about how the teacher can do better. But first, I've got to fix whatever these problems are in the school that I'm responsible for. One of the big ones for me in my school was the schedule. Oh, we had a schedule where, this is elementary school, teachers, at least one teacher at every grade level had a different schedule every day and hardly ever had a common prep with the rest of their team members. And I'd say, well, can you talk about this with your team? And they'd say, yeah, I think I have a common planning with him in 3 weeks. So what's going on here? So I looked at the schedule and I realized that was going to have to be a big part of my work to improve that schedule. And eventually we got common planning, common schedules, common prep time every day for everybody on the team. And that was not something that teachers could have really worked around on their own. I needed to play that leader. I remember when I was a new teacher, my principal did this for me. I wish I had saved this note, but I was a new teacher. I went and checked out my classroom and the book room and the textbooks and all the materials and tried to figure out what had been left for me as I started as a first year science teacher. And I panicked because I didn't have nearly enough textbooks. Like I just had like half of the number of textbooks I needed. So I went to my principal and I will never forget how she wore that leader hat in that moment. Of course, she was super busy. She was answering email and getting phone calls while I was in there. But I'll never forget this thing that she did to support me. She wrote me a little note on a quarter sheet of paper that said, Esther, order 60 of whatever Justin needs. And she gave me that paper. She said, give that to Esther. And that was what I needed. I needed her permission to order the materials that I needed. And all the feedback in the world would not have taken the place of that leadership, that changing the conditions that I was working under. Great comments here. Yeah, remove the roadblocks, Shalisa says. Do all we can do first, control what you can control. Love it. All right. So as we wrap up here, a couple of things I want to recap. You know, the formal observation process is necessary. The formal evaluation process is probably not going to change, and we should keep doing it. But everything we do gets better if we add frequent informal classroom visits to the mix, because it's going to give us so much more in terms of evidence, in terms of relationships, in terms of context, and just knowledge of what needs to happen. So if you haven't seen that model from my book, you can actually get the whole sample chapter at solutiontree.com/21days. I'm giving away 5 copies of the book to people who have been here chatting in the comments today. So definitely check that out. But to kind of put some of this all together, we've got to have those informal visits. We've got to be in classrooms frequently, not just once or twice a year. That obviously is not going to get us there. We do have to meet the requirements of those formal observations. We don't want to get sidetracked by failing to meet a timeline or failing to do something that's required in terms of the paperwork. But we want the heart of this work to be evidence-based, framework-linked feedback conversations. People change their practice not when we give them feedback, but when we have a conversation with them. And the more we have those conversations, the better we are able to make evidence-based decisions about everything that we do, about everything from the schedule to the budget to all of the different improvement decisions that we make. All right, if we make this standard practice, Barbara says, then it doesn't get in the way of having appropriate evidence. Love it. Great, good. All right, so if this is not the reality in your district right now or in your school right now, I wanna give you the very, very, very best way that I have and that I've seen anywhere for you to make that the reality. And I will toot my own horn here a little bit on this program, because we've had so many people who have not only gone through it and benefited personally, but then have made other people go through it because they've got so much value out of it.